Do you think
that... Not usually, but continue.
Welcome to the Commentary Track, a Kamen Rider podcast. I'm your host, Jared.
I'm Cody.
And I'm producer, Jed.
Welcome back, boys. How was the holiday?
That was pretty good, actually. We hosted for the first time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is conjoined family or?
Yeah. Dove's dad was able to come up to visit.
Oh, that's
awesome.
We're
hoping next year to get a bit more of her side as well.
I think we're doing the same. So we did like my family's Christmas in the morning and then my wife's Christmas in the evening. I think next year we're going to try to fuse the family, which will be very interesting.
See, we did that last year, which was part of the reason why this year it was like, no, you're all going to come here.
No, we have the child. You come to us.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely how it should be. Make note, listeners. Be easy on your families.
Anything else?
We can go ahead and do this week's edition of Will It Grong?
Yes.
Because I had a really cool idea. A thresher shark. You know, I'm sure we're going to see a shark eventually. It's too iconic for us to not see a shark at some point. Based upon some of the outro footage last time, I have a strong suspicion I'm going to get to relive my childhood fear of the pool shark this week. But a thresher shark in particular, because thresher sharks have that long tail, so iconic, they'll swim through schools of fish and whip them with the tail. So you could even have a human affectation like a bull whip as like the whipping action, or just, you know, maybe they have like a single cloak. You know, we've seen some of the characters with the half cloak so far. Maybe this one has the mono cloak over one side, like a matador cape or something like that. Could be a cool, unique affectation, but yeah, thresher shark.
So are you proposing that the thresher shark is a go-level Grongy?
I think so, yeah. They're a pretty cool predator, not gonna lie. Very fast.
There is not a thresher shark.
Hmm. Why did I hear emphasis on thresher through that robotic animation of yours?
It's amazing how you read into monotone like that.
Yeah.
Spoilers.
See, there it is. I got Dr. Hood.
We will dub this one Goongazagi from Onigazam, Japanese for thresher shark.
Well, let's revisit some childhood trauma, shall we?
All right. So yeah, we're watching episodes 27 and 28, Ripple and Clarification.
Ripple and Clarification were written by Inoue Toshiki and directed by Watanabe Katsuya. They originally aired on August 6th and 13th, 2000. A jump to the sky turns to a rider review.
Man, since the Go showed up, things are getting really exciting.
Yeah, between the unexplained black tentacle, the... fucking James Dean getting DLC content for his bike in the form of other skins. Like, this has been exciting.
Oh, yeah, shall we take it from the top?
Yes, sir.
So, we start in the Meguro Ward at 2 a.m., and for a moment, I thought we were watching a different Kamen Rider series.
Yeah, I was thinking Step Up. You know, myself, I was expecting Channing Tatum to show up at some point.
I forgot he was in that film series.
He sure was.
But we get a dance crew rehearsing. And then a girl in a rather long black dress with a...
Xiongzam.
Is that the proper name for the article of clothing?
That's the name for the article of clothing or the character?
Clothing. Because her name is Gobemiyogi.
Gobemiyogi, played by Ito Seiko. Her name comes from Umihebi, meaning sea snake.
Oh.
Odd.
So sea snake.
Huh.
We thought it was eel.
Yeah.
She walks through this dance troupe. They don't seem to pay any attention to her at all as she walks right through the middle of their choreography.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes up to their Sony boombox, I think it was. And she hits stop.
Just the rudest shit I've ever seen in my life.
You know, there's been somewhat modern, almost hip-hop-esque music. Mm-hmm. Non-descriptive, generic dance crew music playing. And it stops. And she fiddles with the tuner on the radio portion, right as one of the crew members comes up and is like, hey, what are you doing? And she settles on a piece of classical music. And he grabs her arm, and she turns into her Grongi form, and we cut to the opening credits. And we have...
Wow, with the opening credits.
We have a new opening credits scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sequence entirely. The song is still the same, but the vast majority of the footage is brand new.
Yep, we get to see all of our characters in their newer costumes. We get to see all the weapons displayed for the different rising forms, even the ones we haven't seen yet.
We get to see several of the Go, looks like, in their Grongi forms.
Mm-hmm. There were some fun little spoilers to watch out for. I'm going to have to be paying more attention to the intros again.
Yes. Further proof, this just, it's getting more and more exciting.
Yeah, we're in the late game now. I won't say end game, because that's copyrighted.
From there, we're at Pol Pol. And Godai is cooking
the most brown, unappetizing pot of brown something I've ever seen in my life.
And to emphasize this, he tries some and comments that it doesn't taste good.
Disgusting shit.
I gotta ask, just because there are some things that tend to be patterns or habitualizations between different series, is that a common thing that whoever the common writer is just can't freaking cook? Because I've only seen a couple of series now. I've seen Gotchard, and his whole thing is he wants to make food, and his food is fucking terrible. And now Godai stepped behind the stove for a minute in his adorable little apron and is cooking just sludge in a bowl.
Not really.
Okay, okay.
Sakurako's also there, and they start off having a conversation about the rising forms and how there's not anything in the text about them.
Little interesting.
Godai once again brings up how in the last set of episodes, Tsubaki joked that it was the defibrillator that's caused this to happen. And, you know, I said at the time, yeah, he might be joking, but I think he's also telling the truth and doesn't realize it. Godai says the same thing.
Yeah.
And brings up maybe the previous Kuga, because we know there was one before him, never found these forms because they didn't have access to getting shocked like that.
I mean, it could be even something as simple as, like, never exposed to that extraneous power. Like, we know from some of the stuff that's been discussed so far that the Kuga organism, whatever it is, the integration of the pieces of the suit to an individual person can adapt to different things. We've seen, you know, the belt basically command override Godai's body and shut him down until the spores had faded. And now we've got the electric shock that brought him back, but potentially having adapted to that extra amount of energy present in the body. So my personal, like, assumption here is that it's something to do with the Kuga suit, the Kuga organism's ability to evolve in response to new stimuli. Here's more power, can use more power.
That could very well be it, and I feel like the show will eventually drip feed us an answer. Mm. They've done pretty well so far.
They have. To, like, an almost upsetting degree. They've answered all my questions, and I have nothing to bitch about now.
But they continue on talking, discussing where Pops and Nana, because you may have noticed if you watched the episode that they're not in this scene.
Mm-hmm.
And they ask about the vacation. Like, oh yeah, weren't they going to go to Shohan? And Godai says, oh, now they're at the local pool. And we get a bit of a somber, morose moment where he brings up, well, because of all of the ULF attacks, tourists aren't coming to Pol Pol as much. Funding's probably hard. So yeah, he wanted to go to Shohan, but that's about what he could afford.
Yeah. Proof that Pol Pol's not doing as well as it once was.
Despite those G-men, you'd think they would have at least milked them for the bill.
There were only six of them.
That's enough.
That government credit card.
And to illustrate the point, though, we then cut to Mizusawa Water Park. And if this is the local water park, that's a really nice one. They've got some great looking slides. We get a quick montage of the different attractions. And we get Pops and Nana playing in the water. And Minori is sitting at a table with
Motoki or Motoshiro Keiko, portrayed by Okada Rii. I've seen both versions of her surname. I'm not sure which is correct.
And Minori and Keiko have a brief discussion where she reveals rather quickly that she is pregnant. She must have, like, just found out because she is not showing in any way, shape, or form. But from there, we cut to the research institute. and Ichijo is talking with Inukita. And they bring up that they could not figure out a pattern to ULF-37, Buro.
Correct.
There's also a brief discussion about something called the... It's either BTCS or BTSC.
And they say...
Don't let Godai use the Goram until it's finished. Call the Goram until it's finished. An upgraded bike? Some other sort of vehicle?
She's hot gluing weapons to it.
It's maybe clearly not the Tri-Chaser, because we see that later in the episode.
Yeah, specifically the Goram components.
Yeah, this is some other project that they're working on that this is the first time we've heard mention of.
Dude, if Inokita's research has advanced to the point where she can functionally upgrade this ancient technology, the woman's god tier. Like, that's pretty impressive.
Yes. And as Ichijo's going to leave, Jean walks in.
Continuing to regress in his levels of formal dress.
Yeah, he's now in the most casual outfit we've seen him in.
He's flying more casual than Godai these days.
And Inukita mentions that he's there every day now.
Jean is?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't catch that part.
Yeah, no, she says that he's there helping every day, so presumably he's just... Who knows? Maybe he has figured out how to take the Goram apart and put it back together.
He's trying to get that one piece back for that one kid that gave it to him. He's like,
he's just making sure that that's okay.
Yeah. He was assigned a task.
And then we cut to a...
Goth bar.
Goth bar, cabaret lounge.
Yeah.
Halloween attraction. Hard to say.
Main hallways, rebar spikes, you know.
Dungeon cellar.
Yeah, your typical Tuesday night hangout spot.
And Labaruba Day and Gomagoo are just... walking through there, they open a gate, step through, and Gogadol Ba steps out from a separate cell and stops and comments on how impressive it was that Godai was able to kill Buro. You know, maybe if he'd focused on combat a little more than French absurdist philosophy. Although, you know, thinking about it, the world in which Kuga takes place certainly falls into Camus' definition of absurdism.
You know, I did go back and, like, do the Cliff's Notes version of Camus just to, like, refresh my memory on it. You're not wrong.
I did the same thing.
But, like, they show a level of borderline genre awareness in this that is so frustrating to watch. They're like, yeah, no, Kuga adds a thrill to the game, like a threat of death. His presence in the game isn't necessary. All of the Grongi that have died so far are them indulging his presence instead of, like, actively trying to remove him.
Yeah.
They treat him like an annoyance, despite the fact that he's continually working his way up the food chain, and that's a little weird.
He's not an antagonist to them. He's a feature of the game.
Yeah, the fact that consistently all of them have failed their games, but, like, what, one?
Yeah.
Have there been any off-screens? No, one has
Galma
succeeded.
Ray was the only one.
And every single one has failed because of Kuga to some level, with a couple notable miniature exceptions, like one person just, you know, tripping over their own dick and, you know, eating, yeah, whatever. But, like, the fact that he's performing, like, a localized Grongi genocide, and they're like, what an inconvenience. Darn.
One of us will get it.
They're so close. They're so close to getting it. They bring him up, talk about it. It's like, yeah, that adds a thrill to the game, doesn't it? Well, anyway, who's next?
And Gadol asks if Bimiyu is going to be the next one. And while this conversation is going on, Gomagoo is scratching himself.
Yeah, he's got a level of chest eczema that is uncomfortable for the people in his immediate vicinity because they both just turn and stare at him until he stops.
Then Barubade's like, come on, let's go.
And come on, Ichi.
They just continue walking. Gadol seems to keep standing there. And we cut to the dolphin pool and river ride.
Ooh.
We see Bemiu get in. There's a couple flashes of stuff under the water.
Black tentacle.
Yeah. And people floating face down. And as we have established, Doldo is there counting kills. An important thing to bring up is that as she is entering, we see that Bimyu is holding a sleeve of sheet music.
Yes.
And there is a comment made about enjoy the melody. This seems to hint at her self-imposed rule for the game, but it doesn't make any sense, and we'll talk about it potentially a bit more as we go along. Yeah.
This is one of the more abstract ones we've seen. A little harder to suss out. Some of these have been pretty obvious. This one's a little harder.
You have no idea.
I hope it's not silly. Is it silly?
Depending on your definition.
So, yeah, that sounds like a heart confirm.
We cut back to Pol-Pol from here, and they're pretty busy.
Mm-hmm.
Godai is cooking. Sakurako is taking orders.
He appears to have improved his recipe because people are actually ordering it.
Yes. And the phone rings.
Prawn curry?
Yes.
Fried prawn curry?
Yes. Godai finishes plating a thing of fried prawn curry for Sakurako to take to someone as she puts in an order for more curry and iced coffee and iced tea.
It all comes out of the same pot, weirdly enough. It's just several different levels of brown.
Yes. But the phone rings. Sakurako picks it up. It's Tsubaki. And he's trying to ask her out on a date.
Yeah, man, he shoots his shot.
He's like, hey, this is the first time I've had a day off in ages. Do you want to go do something? And she's like, I'm actually kind of busy. Could you come help? And Tsubaki, a trained medical professional
and alleged serial killer,
decides that he's going to go work at Pol-Pol.
On his one day off in a while, he gets recruited to go work at a restaurant.
Yes. Everybody ends up working at Pol-Pol eventually.
Mm-hmm. Pops is like a gravitational well. He just draws in any named character to work. We're going to see Sugita working at Pol-Pol before the series is over.
We cut back to the Mizusawa water park, and Pops and Nana have gotten out of the water and are standing on one side of a pool. We still have Minori and Keiko sitting there talking, and they're having a discussion about pregnancy and how, from Minori's point of view, how strange it is. And they have some discussion about, you know, what it must feel like to, you know that there's a life growing inside you. And Keiko gets a little morose and, you know, brings up a very valid fear for the world that they live in. She's like, you know, what do you think it's going to be like when they're here? Is the world going to be safer when the baby is born? And there's, what, 200 plus empty graves at the site in Nagano. Sure, we know that all of the zoo and the meh are dead at this point, but there's still Go. We don't know if there's more La or Rei. Lord Raiden is still out there. There could be other classes of Gorongi that we still have yet to be introduced to. It's a very valid fear. You know, what's going to happen? How long are the ULF attacks going to go on?
Listen, we can just bog standard it at. We've established that this is a universe where monsters can exist. Like, all bets are off.
Yeah.
Another 21 episodes.
Fair.
And then the universe collapses.
Let's see, 21 episodes. This is mostly two episode arc. So, okay, there's like 11 more Gorongi that we're going to see.
Oh, wow. That's a
lot less than the 200 plus, even including the off-screened ones.
We take some of them in batches, Jared. Everybody jump into the big brown pot. Oh, God, it's Gorongi meat. That's why we didn't see the prawn Gorongi.
That's true. We did already off-screen the shrimp Gorongi.
Jed, he's serving Gorongi at Pol-Pol. Oh, my God. Pol-Pol's short on money. This is a Sweeney Todd situation.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Pops.
There was nothing left from that Gorongi. Yeah, no, nothing. Nothing to recover. Nothing at all. Pops just dragging a big trash bag off under the overpass.
We cut to Ichijo inside his car when Nozomi comes over the radio and announces that there's been some murders at the dolphin pool in River Ride that they suspected is a ULF attack, but that they had no one saw the murderer. Ichijo responds that he's on his way, flips a switch, and a portion of the roof of his car flips over to have the light.
Like Spy Kids style.
That was really cool, and I hope Japanese police cars genuinely do that, and that wasn't just something for this show.
I'm literally taking notes on things from this episode that I want to look up. But yeah, I would also like to have an answer to that question.
Yes. So we cut to the Rex's swimming school.
It's real. It's real. Unmarked cars in Japan have a hidden panel in the roof, so it's just driving around looking like, you know, it's a regular brown bag car until they need to pull somebody over, and then a panel opens in the roof.
That's awesome. It's real. That's so cool.
Man, that looks campy as hell. If I ever got pulled over by, like, an undercover Japanese cop, I'd have to stop laughing long enough to hand over my paperwork.
It's honestly cooler than just, like, the lights up in the corner of the windshield, like, American unmarked.
Need a little camp in my law enforcement.
We cut to the Rex's swimming pool, and we see Bimyu just walking out of the building, and we hear some people starting to call names. We immediately cut back to Polpol. Sakuraga's bringing another order. It sounds very similar to the first one.
It's one thing. Limited menu.
Phone rings. This time, Godai picks it up. It's Ichijo. He informs him there's been some attacks. Looks like ULF. We don't know for certain. We haven't figured out a pattern yet. And Godai's like, where do I need to go? And Godai runs out, briefly handing his apron to Sakurako. And she just sort of stares dumbfounded as a woman asks if her order is ready yet.
Poor Sakurako.
Indeed. We cut back to the Mizusawa water park, and Pops, Nana, Minori, and Keiko are leaving. And as they're walking out, Bimyu walks past them.
Man, we are getting so close. They love to remind us with the series how close our ancillary characters are to danger, like, at all times.
This is written by the same person who wrote the Garima episodes, which was the last time one of our main characters had a brush with death.
That makes sense.
They are very talented what they're doing.
Bimyu walks past our cast of side characters in the pool, and it's the whole slow-mo shot, too.
Yes, it's the slow walking to show, you know,
just how narrowly they miss this, yeah.
And we cut to the dolphin pool, and Ichijo's there, and Sugita's talking with them. And he brings up that there were 16 victims, and that they all have a burn on their chests.
Mm-hmm.
And Sugita brings up a valid point. As crowded as this pool was, why only 16?
I'm assuming it has something to do with musical measures.
This is a good time to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know she's been clutching the sheaf of music. And something I noticed is that at least part of the pool had lanes set up. And in a weird way, you could read those as the staff lines on a sheet music. So is she killing people to try and replicate the piece of music she's carrying around?
I want to say that's incredibly stupid, but you were right about the owl pellets, so I'm not discounting your your casual idle speculation.
Like, 16 beats is a fairly common measure of music to use for something.
Mm-hmm. I didn't pay enough attention to the sheet music she was carrying to see, like...
There was a scene before she went into one of the buildings where she is looking at, and the camera lingers on several of the notes.
Okay.
It's gotta be related somehow, or else this makes no sense.
Yeah. I want to look up that piece of music she was holding.
But while they're having this conversation, Sakurai calls and informs that there have been more murders at Rexus. And they do a sound thing, and Ichijo's like, all right, we'll tell all local pools and water parks to temporarily close.
Yeah, they said city water parks, which makes sense because our next location is a private pool.
Yeah. We cut back to Mizusawa Water Park. We already know that our supporting cast has left.
Mm-hmm.
But we do see Bimyu underwater. She climbs out and walks towards, like, under one of the slides as someone notices that, hey, the person they were talking to is no longer responding.
It's the worst time to start a game of Marco Polo. Marco. Marco?
Doldo flips a couple more beads.
No, it's Polo.
On his abacus.
Marco. Doldo.
Close. Whatever.
He hasn't talked since Garima. Which is interesting that he is a silent Gorongi.
Yeah, he's just observing and recording.
But I guess, you know, especially since he's got that, like, Rick Astley shockingly deep voice.
Yeah, he does. I miss it. He also displays, like, a remarkable humility for one of the Gorongi. Like, every Gorongi we've met has been almost cosmic levels of arrogant. And for him to just be, for everybody else's games, walking around counting as they do their thing, and never to complain about it, never to say anything about it. Like, that's a level of investment and participation we haven't seen yet from the others. Most of the others have been fairly selfish, and he just kind of does the job.
Well, it was also, you know, like, the concern him and even Baruba showed towards Burrow last time. Maybe the go just get more?
Hmm.
We cut back to Polpol. Sakurako's there. Pops and Nana show up. The rush is over, thankfully. And Tsubaki comes in, and he's very clearly holding flowers behind his back.
Oh. He's actually trying. I'm impressed with our boy.
Yeah.
Like, Tsubaki's clearly trying. It's his one day off. He volunteered to come here and help. Like, he brought flowers. Like, he's interested in Sakurako for sure. Is he still going to turn her spine into a coat rack? Probably, but there will be romance first.
But he says he's there to help, and Pops is like, I don't think I've seen you before. Do you work here? Are you on my payroll?
Even Pops does not know how far the employment of Polpol has spread.
He does not. And Sakuraka is like, the rush is kind of over at this point, but thanks for showing up.
Thanks, bud.
We cut to the Rex's swimming pool. Ichijo is there.
Oh, doesn't he immediately also get called away? Or is that another scene?
Ichijo then calls Tsubaki. Yeah. So we get a quick flash back to Polpol for him answering the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Ichijo tells him, hey, these are obviously Gorongi victims. We need you to come in. And Tsubaki hangs up the phone, looks at Sakuraga, and is like, I have to go back to work. There's been another incident. And he takes the flowers out and hands them to her and walks out the door.
Damn. That sucks. Like, potential for date on your one day off, then you get called into work after realizing you weren't needed on the date after all. Like,
yeah.
Damn, Tsubaki's having a rough time.
This is why he murders people.
I was just gonna say I'd get a little stabby myself.
I'm so tired.
We get to Godai. And Nozomi makes the announcement over the police broadcast that there have been more victims found at Mizusawa. As we know, all comms are open comms, so Godai hears it too.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, there's another motorcycle. James Dean has shown up and seems to be just fucking with him?
Yeah, wasting his time, doing some bike tricks, showing off his sweet new moves.
Because all he's doing is he speeds past, gets in front of Godai, and then just starts weaving.
Godai, of course, gives chase.
Yeah. We cut inside the Motoki household. Minori's there with Keiko. And they get the news report of the attacks. And that the kill count is now up to 56.
Still breaks down by eights.
So, yeah, this is tying to music somehow.
Mm-hmm. It could just be the number of victims per pool.
Maybe?
Like, it could be, like, the number of victims per pool is the number of notes per measure.
That, yeah, I could see that.
Like, it's less contrived than, oh, this pool's got lines in it, I guess I can kill here today.
We'll find out in the second episode, I'm sure. But as they hear the announcement that the most recent set of killings have happened at Mizusawa, Keiko, realizing how close her and her unborn child have come to certain death, passes out. We cut to a private hotel pool, and we see two people just suddenly go slack in the water as Bimyu climbs up out of the water directly at the screen.
Oh, God. And with the most, like, some kid just pooped in the pool expression on her face, too. Like, she got a poopy face on when she climbs out of the pool.
What was the name of the hotel?
It's the Mirage Hotel. Yes.
Hmm. Is that important? Mm. Interesting.
As she walks away, Doldo once again steps into camera and, yeah, I get they're probably distracted with, hey, why are these people suddenly non-responsive? But no one notices the man head wrapped and partially obscured standing in front of the pool.
Yeah, the man like
E.T. Fields.
E.T. Fields, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, the man's like 60% scarf. He stands out in a crowd.
Yeah. We got back to the road. Godai and Bada are still chasing each other some more. And Bada's finally like, we're going to go over this way.
And Godai's like, well, fine. And follows him.
And for the next little bit, we kind of bounce back and forth. Because we get a quick cut back to the hotel as Bimyu is walking down a hallway. And she looks slightly to her right. And there is a gorgeous purple felt-lined grand piano.
Yep. And with a beautiful mind-level compulsion, she goes, sits down, arranges her music, and starts to play.
And the music will continue playing over the rest of the episode.
Yeah, which, you know, provided a cool and very, very different background vibe. Because, you know, we do end up flipping back to the warehouse, the ongoing bike combat between Godai and Bada. And, like, this almost ethereal classical music underscores like kind of the balance in their abilities. Like Bada's not just another bad guy. He and Godai are going toe to toe on the motorcycle tricks they're doing, the combat practices they're doing. It's close for a while. And that music serves to underscore that in a really unsettling way.
So as we get into the warehouse, Godai is in front and Bada pulls a wheelie and taps the back of Godai's tri-chaser twice.
This is the most condescending bike foo I've ever seen in my life.
They end up turning, facing each other. And Bada takes his helmet off and he looks familiar now that we're really getting a good look at his face.
Mm-hmm.
He looks like Bodzu.
Exactly like Bodzu. Like same actor level, exactly like Bodzu.
It is the same actor.
Yeah.
So he's playing two characters.
Mm-hmm. And wouldn't you know it, they're when he both transforms. Grass-up.
And this is fun, because he strikes Godai's pose.
Yeah, he does.
And does...
He strikes Hongo's pose.
Who the hell Hongo?
Hongo from the original Kamen Rider. He strikes Hongo's... Sure, but Godai also does Hongo's pose.
He does a full Henshin, like, transformation sequence. Fucking Rider style.
And... Yeah, he's just...
You see the Tri-Chaser transform first.
Well, hold on. Bada transforms.
Mm-hmm.
Godai, in response, transforms. Godai transforms the Tri-Chaser, and Bada rips off a spike from his elbow and taps it to the motorcycle, and it transforms.
God, and that bike was so sick. They did like a burnished bronze, like an old ancient bronze look to the metal of it. That looks like filigreed edges. The whole thing looked like armor. It was really cool.
I wonder if this is meaningful.
I mean, it's showing the same abilities as Godai.
Yeah.
And there's already been questions raised about the relationship between Kuga and the Gorongi. And now we're starting to see even more similar. Makes me wonder if we're going to see additional Grongi be able to do the same sort of thing.
It makes me wonder what Kuga actually was. Like, is Kuga a Grongi that went renegade and decided to, like, stop the games? Like, what was the original Kuga that they share all of these abilities? It can't just be that they conveniently have the same type of magic and stuff. Like, they're related.
The Goram speaking in Grongi as well as in Linto?
Yep.
Yeah, these things are very clearly more intertwined than at least Godai and the rest of the human cast understand. I think more than we understand currently, but we're starting to get a better picture of it.
Mm-hmm.
But to keep things moving, we get some great bike foo.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Full on proper jousting with each other.
Like, yes, you're absolutely correct. The majority of this bike foo was absolutely stunning, watching them go at it, twists and turns and jousting. But then there was a little part where they both were on wheelies and, like, were slapping the front tire of the bikes back and forth. It reminded me of, like, two kids, like, slap fighting each other, but nobody's willing to, like, actually hit the other person in the face. I loved it. It was so silly. I loved it. It took me out of it for a moment, but then we were right back in with the wheelie competition.
Interspersed throughout this, we keep cutting back to Bimyu playing on the piano.
Mm-hmm.
And we get this incredible moment of Bada and Godai charging at each other. And they leap off of the bikes and they clash in midair as the bikes go zooming past each other. Godai lands back on the tri-chaser.
And Bada
is nowhere to be seen. Yeah. And Godai is kind of looking around.
He doesn't check the one place he should, which was the very conveniently stacked boxes behind him.
And Bada comes smashing
through. And his name is John C.
Yeah, 100%. Just bike foos him right in the chest.
Perfectly T-bones. Godai goes flying off of the tri-chaser, crashes through a bunch of conveniently placed gasoline cans. Bada had this set up from the get-go, I'm convinced. Because he picked the warehouse.
Either that or he's just got, like, incredible villain powers. Because he knocks him into a pile of flammable things, one of which falls over, and the impact of Godai's armor against the metal causes enough sparks that the whole thing goes kablooey.
Yeah. End of episode.
Here's hoping the Kuga armor adapts to whatever elemental energy it's given. We had lightning. This is maybe fire, or maybe we're just going to get toasty, toasty Godai. The world may never know.
Let's watch the next episode and find out.
Oh, right. Well, we finally found an episode where Jared has a reason to be excited about something blue.
Strange miracles happen.
All right, take us from the top, buddy.
So we start off with a reshoot of the end of the last episode. We get to see Bada crashing in through the boxes, knocking Godai off the bike into the cans of gasoline. You pointed out there's a lot of feathers around
there
for
so
some
many
reason.
Feathers. Like, there's paint stripper, thinner, nothing in this appears to be related to poultry, but there are feathers everywhere.
Maybe there were just a bunch of pillows. Maybe the...
Pigeons. It's abandoned?
Yeah. Could be.
Maybe.
Maybe one of the stunt mats tore.
Possibly.
I don't think those are filled with feathers. At least I would hope they're not.
Maybe Godai's actually three large chickens in an outfit. We'll never know. But, yeah. You know, in through the conveniently stacked boxes, out through the conveniently stacked explosives.
We get the explosion. Godai gets up, sees that Bada is now outside.
Mm-hmm.
Comes revving straight in. He jumps back on the tri-chaser for this next scene, because it's really cool.
Yep.
And he vaults
defies
over
gravity.
Bada.
There's no ramp. He just suddenly just uppies the bike over him.
Presses 2. I'm pretty sure that was the one with jump jets for the Mach 5.
So we're now just Speed Racer.
Yes. There's a storied history of this happening.
You know what? You're not wrong.
Hongo did the same thing. He lands outside. Bada is now inside. For some reason.
Nope, we discussed this, Jared. They ran out of cool juice.
Yes, they ran out of cool juice because Bada is back to his human disguise. The bike is back to being just its normal motorcycle self. And Godai, out of pure respect or also having run out of cool juice, has also powered down.
You know, either way.
Bada leaves. We get the credits.
Bada bye?
Yes.
Yeah.
God, Bada's so cool.
See? It's recharging. The minute he transforms back to human form, we're all just like, damn, that's a sexy homie. Hmm. He could get away with lots of stuff.
Oh, God, is he sexy?
It's... That just makes the fact that we call him James Dean so much more apt.
Yep. We, for once, are all of one mind, and it's that bug man on that motorcycle is sexy as fuck.
Yeah. We get the opening credits. We need to study these more to see what other hints there might be about what's coming in the future.
Mm-hmm.
We cut to the Mirage Hotel. Ichijo has just shown up, and
there's
piano
music playing.
As he comes inside, there's still piano music.
God, he just... Every character in this is so min-maxed. Like, Ichijo can figure out anything off a phone call, scrap of paper, a third of a rose petal, and the ramblings of his lover. But they can't clear a crime scene worth a shit. They let somebody stay within the bounds of their little crime scene, continuing to play the piano.
All the other cops ignored her, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
And Ichijo stops and kind of stares because, hey, this is an active crime scene. People have been murdered and you're playing the piano? But right as he's about to approach and say something, he gets called away by Sakurai. He's like, hey, the crime scene's over here. And so he leaves, and she gets up and walks away.
Doop, 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 doop.
We find out that there's only been the two victims we saw. And this doesn't make any sense, because at the first one, there were 16. At the second, there were 24. The third, there were 16, and now two. These numbers don't match up. The last one, it was always in groups of 9. Is this a new part of the game? Who can say? Also, all of these are still happening just at pools.
Yep.
We cut to Pol Pol. And Sakurako, Pops, and Nana are there. They're just briefly talking, and they make the stupidest decision.
The same mistake that all of our aging parents make, and they turn on the news.
And immediately, there's the discussion about the victims at the Mizusawa Water Park. And they all once again have the realization they were just there. And Pops, in a beautiful moment of clarity on his part, comes over and unplugs the TV.
Yeah, no turn it off. Straight pulls the cord out of the wall. He's like, we're done. We're done with the news.
Yep.
Emotional damage!
Yes.
Speaking of emotional damage.
The phone rings. Pops picks it up. It's Minori. And she asks if they saw the news. And Pops is like, yeah, we did. Don't want any more of that.
Opting out.
Ask how Nana is doing. And, you know, Nana, who already had to take time off from work being so shocked over when Galma Ray killed her acting teacher. She's really grappling with her own mortality at this moment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Sakurako's doing her best to comfort her. And Pop's like, I guess you saw too then, and that's why you're calling? And Minori's like, yeah, I happened to be with Keiko when we saw it. She took it pretty hard.
To the head, because she fell on linoleum.
She makes a comment about how she's also slightly anemic, so that probably didn't help. Mm-hmm. She's called Keiko's husband. He's on his way home. We cut to a bridge, and thank God to save us from just this moment. Oh, it is, of course, worth mentioning. How could I forget? As Minori is on the phone, Keiko wakes up.
Just in time for her turn to talk.
Yes. And hand to her stomach, and it's a repeat of the line, you know, what will they be like growing up in this world? You know, what can they expect? And we then cut to a bridge, and thank God, it's Baruba and Bada. And he just oozes cool.
He can ooze on me.
Yeah, he's leaning on a bridge, nonchalant as hell.
Flipping his coin. If he'd been, like, chewing on a toothpick or smoking a cigarette while he was at it as well.
They don't even have to say it. They don't have to show it. I know that man smokes unfiltered Marlboro Reds. He smokes cowboy killers.
Yeah.
Producer's note. The commentary track does not condone smoking cigarettes, filtered or unfiltered. Even if it is kind of sexy. That's how you get cancer.
And Baruba's like, what do you think about him? And he's like, yeah,
he's cute. Kuga's
all right.
Oh, like that.
I don't think he's going to get in the way of the game. but he's certainly going to make it more exciting.
And he says, not thinking about the fact that everyone who's encountered Kuga has died so far.
Yeah, but he's won every encounter he's had against Kuga so far.
Did he win? Or did he run out of cool juice and have to putt-putt away?
Little of column A, little of column B. But this gets a rare smile from Baruba.
It was almost more unsettling than when she was killing people.
We've never seen her kill people.
No, we've just seen her choke a couple of people with, like, plant hands.
One person.
Multiple times.
You know, really just the only one
we needed to. Not even a person, Goma.
Whoa, Father Jose is a person, okay?
I mean, he does seem to be doing better, other than the eczema.
He's not used to, like, positive feedback. It's making him itchy. Aww. Somebody told him good job, and now he's just deeply uncomfortable.
He would give his life for Godol because he told him thank you.
Yeah, he just needs a head pat every once in a while, and he's good to go. He's a good boy. You're doing so good. Power of positive reinforcement, Jetty.
We got some kind of reaction out of him for what we just said.
Do you need head pats and to be told you're a good boy?
Yes, but not by you.
That's valid.
I'm scared we inadvertently hit on something.
Jetty's inadvertently hitting on something.
We cut back to the Mirage Hotel. Godai has shown up. And he's talking to Ichijo. And this is going to be a lot to explain.
Yep.
Because they're at first discussing this doesn't seem to have a pattern. And Godai brings up that with Garima Ba, it was everyone who was on the same train car. And Ichijo's like, yeah, but that's not the case for 37 or this one.
And then Godai just kind of himbo rambles for a while about both of them not making any connections, but that's enough to trigger Ichijo's superpower because all of a sudden...
So, like, Ichijo brings up that with 37, that it was... The victims were in groups of 9. But that's not the case here. These aren't matching. And Goda's like, have you noticed that with these new ones, they seem to be moving around Tokyo a lot? It seems inefficient the way
they're
doing things.
Yeah, there's a really inefficient way of
them wandering
around.
Do they have to keep changing location? And this rambling is enough. Ichijo starts to put some pieces together, and he runs back into the hotel.
Mm-hmm. And we get, what was the name of the shot?
Well, before that, we get this incredible rack zoom, because the camera focuses in, but their position doesn't actually change, but the background fades out around them. Oh, it's so good.
For those of you who haven't watched and darn familiar with what a rack zoom is, like, picture Chief Brody in Jaws the first time he sees, like, the shark actually get somebody where the camera zooms, but his face stays still. Yeah, very effective piece of cinematography. Yeah.
And I don't think we've seen them use that shot yet, but this was the perfect time to do it. It's great for conveying the pieces have come together. You have made a startling realization. And he books it inside. They head back towards the piano, but they get a call from Tsubaki. And Tsubaki is explaining that he's looked at the victims, that they have died from a heart attack caused by an extreme change in temperature. Remember how we reported before that everyone had a burn mark on their chest? This isn't just a burn. This is frostbite. And it is, Tsubaki concludes that they are being struck with something that is rapidly cooling to between negative 100 and negative 150 degrees Celsius.
That is an insane temperature differential, especially for localized. That's negative 238 degrees Fahrenheit.
It is so cold in such a localized spot that it causes the people to have spontaneous heart attacks. And Tsubaki points out, there's nothing man-made that can reach temperatures like that, especially not in such a small, confined space.
Yeah, and not without, like, an exceptional amount of time. Like, this is a fast process. These people are getting off in front of their loved ones with people around. Nobody's noticing what does it, but...
Yeah. in the hotel, Ichijo processes all this, and he looks at the piano and notices that there is water on the keys. He gets a call from Sugita, and he's putting the pieces together. And he's figured it out. And bear with me. You know what? No, I'm going to save explaining the plan for after we do this week's Tropusatsu.
Oh, it is very, very appropriate.
And this week's Tropusatsu is complexity addiction. So, I'm sure you've heard of Occam's Razor. The stipulation that when you have two or more competing options to solve a problem, you should pick the simplest one. It's almost always correct. Things are never as complicated as you make them out to be. Or, you know, as the old saying goes, keep it simple, stupid. Well, guess what?
It goes the other way, too.
Let's meet stupid. Because some people, or grungy, just can't help themselves. Maybe they need to show how smart they are. Maybe it's for artistic expression. Maybe it's boredom, or they are genuinely insane. But this is a hallmark trope of the insanely prepared, the Riddler, a lot.
Yeah. Brings to mind, like, a lot of Anthony Hopkins characters from his, like, more complex murder movies.
Or Xanatos from Gargoyles.
Yep.
Which I'm sure at some point we'll get into Xanatos Gambit in one of our series at some point. It is worth mentioning that complexity addiction can fall victim to multi-gambit pileup when complex plan after complex plan come crashing together. Many grungy have sort of fallen into this. This seems to be more a go thing, though.
Yeah.
And those who were trying to be go, but my God, this one is the most complex, and it's so smart it becomes stupid again.
Yeah, a lot of times when we get into this kind of territory, we often see opportunities for villains to defeat themselves. Their plan is so arbitrary and complex that just the number of spinning plates is what brings them down.
So let's go ahead and talk about this plan. So,
speaking of spinning plates.
And because...
All right, I'll help. We'll get there.
The locations, the first two letters of each location are music notes. We originally had Dolphin.
Do.
Then we had Rexus.
Ray.
Then we had Mizusaru. Me. And then Mirage. Me again. And then the number of victims equate to what type of note. The pools are the notes.
Mm-hmm.
The victims are what length of note this is. So we get the two victims at the end were just a half note.
Yes.
Eight victims is an eight note. 16 victims, a 16th note. The 24 at Rexus was eight adults and 16 children. And that represented an eighth note connected to a 16th.
Yep. It is the most artificially complex, unnecessary thing I've ever seen in my life. Jared, I have to apologize because I thought your idea of like the lines in the pool, like the swimming lanes and like killing people in different lanes to represent the music notes, I thought that was silly and contrived. And then we got to the real answer. Can we go back to yours?
Yeah, somehow my ludicrous idea was less complicated.
Yeah, I'm reminded, oh, there's that one line. Glass Onion, the Knives Out movie. Yeah. Where he says, like, it's so stupid. And the next person goes, it's so stupid, it's brilliant. And he goes, no, it's just stupid. That's what gets me here. You have introduced so many unnecessary, arbitrary points of failure.
We also... Oh, no, we'll finish the Tropusatsu, and then we'll get to the coda on this.
Yep.
Her plan is so convoluted, so complex, that it becomes her downfall, because they just cut off access to the water.
Mm-hmm.
With all pools, they even start closing down beaches. And once they figured out her pattern, that's it. They then know where she goes, and she gets one more victim. And then she loses. If she'd come up with something less complicated, she could have been more effective.
Yeah, she had an incredibly quick, incredibly effective method of killing.
In her defense, they only figured it out from her playing the piano.
And leaving water on the keys, which was rude as shit.
Seriously, that's very real nice ivory.
Yeah.
For that one.
Mm-hmm. That's terrible. You'd think a lover of music, you know. Okay, but do we give her credit on the fact that this is clearly based on her inability to walk by the piano and not play the music? Is there a air of compulsive behavior that this plays into? Because I think that has to be made. Like, because she walks by the piano, she's on her way out, she's free and clear. And then she sees the piano and she has to stop and play. She carries this music around with her everywhere she goes. She looks for it on the radio. Like, it's a compulsion for her. So maybe, and we didn't discuss one of the things that they brought up over our last...
I was going to get to that.
Yeah, Al Pellet's McSpit face. He was offing people 9 at the time in the order of the Japanese alphabet as the characters appeared. So whatever like the name of the place was, it was in order of the Japanese alphabet.
Which simultaneously makes what he was doing last set far more fascinating and kind of dumb at the same time.
I mean, sure, but think about it, because that one, we didn't have any extra clues other than just
9 at a time.
There was a level of complexity, there was something subtle and hidden to it, but it wasn't so robustly complex on every level that there are more failure points. I feel like they probably would have figured this one out eventually just because of the number of pieces interplaying. You start pulling on any one given thread, eventually the ball comes loose. It took us a whole nother episode and another Grongi engaging in a more complicated game for us to catch up to what, you know, Birdman was doing.
While they have figured hers out.
Yep.
And Ichijo brings up, well, we need to figure out what the next note of the piece of music is. And Goda's like, oh, it's Chopin's Revolutionary Etude. The next note is so. And sure enough, we cut to the Soshigaya center pool. Bemiru's there. No one else is there. And she's mad.
Okay, so this is interesting. Just pulled up the Revolutionary Etude today, and one of the qualities of it is it's considered an interesting piece because of the compulsive nature of it, in that it gets increasingly complex and physically demanding as you continue going through the patterns in the music. So, interesting with our compulsive character being fixated on this music, where it also gets more and more complicated and more challenging to perform as you continue going through the piece of music.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
We cut to the Motoki household. Keiko and Midori are there. And Keiko is, of course, rightly scared. You know, I don't think that I'm going to be bringing a child into a safe world. This is terrifying. Yes, this is a world where monsters exist. And they are burdened with the knowledge that monsters exist. And Midori brings up, like, yes, the world is scary. That things are going to be rough. And most likely things will go rough more than they will go smooth and easy. But think of it this way. They'll have friends. They'll have moments that they cherish. Find love. Get married. Maybe have kids of their own. Your parents probably had the same fears for you. We can't know what the future holds. But we can't let that keep us from moving forward. Yes, things will be rough and scary for your child, but things will also be good. And that's worth it. And not to get too personal, and obviously not quite on the same scale, because as far as I know, we don't live in a world where actual monsters of this scale exist.
Have you not seen the National Enquirer and their coverage of Bat Boy? We discussed this.
We did. Bat Boy's harmless.
He married the Loch Ness Monster to Paris Hilton, Jared. How harmless could he be?
That's a different kind of existential terror. But, like, I had these conversations with Dove, and they went much the same way. And I'm once again so blown away that a show that nominally is aimed at preteen boys is having such a mature adult conversation about a very real anxiety that people go through.
See, that's interesting to me because this one didn't work for me as much. And it might be your position as a new parent that kind of led you to connect with that character on that level. But for me, as we went through this, I felt like a lot of our emotional challenges that faced some of our other characters were a little more robust, a little more fleshed out. For her, her character felt to me very one-dimensional. We're reintroduced to her. We established that she's a pregnant character because she puts her hand on her stomach in every scene she's in. I will say, I think that's kind of cool how they have presented different characters with different emotional challenges at different stages of their life that will come into contact with different fans going through different things and with different emotional struggles and connect with that person.
I think very much it is my lived experience, just like when Junichi dealing with his illness connected with Jed much more than you or me. This one connected with me.
I connected to her too.
Oh, so I'm the asshole. Awesome.
Let's keep going. That was quite the derailment we went
on.
But I feel this a very important thing to talk about.
Yeah.
So we cut to the Research Institute. Ninakita and Jean are there. And Jean pulls out a book and hands it to Ninakita. And it is a book of paper crafts. And if you recall, the last time Ninakita focused story, one of the things was she was supposed to build paper crafts with her child and didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And she realizes that, you know, oh yeah, this was the last beat of my story. And she gets kind of upset about it and asks, like, why are you giving this to me? And Jean's like, you clearly care about your work. It's very important to you. And that's something that I admire about you a lot. But I think your son misses you. And you were supposed to do this with him. I think you should.
I have completely lost track of Jean's role in the story. Because now he seems like the emotional support character for our, you know, secondary and tertiary characters. That's not the role I'd, you know, seen him in when we first encountered Jean at all.
Yeah.
He got his fix of plums and now he's able to be a normal human.
She's clearly mulling over what he said when we cut to Godai and Ichijo going down the street. Again, all comms are open comms, so they're talking to Sugita about they've blocked off these sections of public beach. There's only so many places that end in so that they can get to. Ichijo and Godai are like, we're going to go to this one because it's the most populated beach normally. Sugita's like, all right, I'll take care of this other one. We cut to Polpol. Sakurako, Pops, and Nana are still there. Phone rings. Pops picks it up and says, oh, hey, sis. It's Nana's mom.
Mm-hmm.
He briefly talks and is like, no, Nana's here. Here. Hands the phone to her. She has a quick conversation with her mom. Hangs up. I was like, everything okay? And Nana's like, mom's concerned about me. Wanted to make sure that I was okay. She said that I can come home if I want to. But when I made up my mind to come here to Tokyo, she told me to, you know, pursue what I want and live a life without regrets. So I'm going to stay here. And everyone seems happy about this.
They have a big old group hug about it.
And it's just nice to see family being supportive.
God, isn't it though? Those are the green flags we're looking for in family members, is, you know, just unrelenting support.
We cut to Satora Beach. And we see that Bimuru is there, and farther down left of her are people playing, because they haven't cleared the entire beach, but it's pretty empty for what it looks like.
We need bait.
And she walks out into the water. Godai and Ichijo show up, and we get a scene of the beachgoers. And there's the same kind of generic dance crew music that was playing at the beginning of Ripple. And one of them's like, hey, throw the ball here. And one of the people who's still on the sand picks up a giant beach ball, tosses it into the water.
Okay. Camaraderie and fun.
Yes. And the guy who went to catch the ball all of a sudden sinks.
Mm-hmm.
And a moment later, Bimyu pops out of the water and there's running and screaming. She goes to strike with her whip, and then there's sand pops up because Ichijo decided that this was a good time to pop the cooldown, he has his rifle.
Yeah, she gets popped in the chest by the rifle.
Drops her whip. Godai, Henshin, picks up the stick, turns it into the dragon rod. She reaches down and pulls off one of her anklets and turns it into the whip. And once again, we're seeing the Go transmute things on an atomic level just like Kuga does.
Yeah, weird. Anklet into whip, you know, random beach stick into dragon, what's it, the dragon staff?
Dragon rod.
Dragon rod.
And they have an admittedly pretty cool fight scene.
Yeah.
And at one point, her whip goes right across his shoulder and it flash freezes.
Yeah, frosts over immediately.
And it stays that way for the next good bit of the fight. She even wraps it around the point, or one of the ends, freezes the staff solid, so when he goes to do Splash Dragon, it just hits her and shatters.
Yeah, so we're talking like liquid nitrogen levels of super cooling anything that comes into contact with this whip.
Yes. She ends up throwing him into a shack. And he comes out, tries to strike with the remaining piece of the dragon rod one more time. She rips it out and throws it. And he looks around, and wouldn't you know it, as luck would have it, there's another stick. He does not pick it up immediately. She goes to strike. He jumps, spins, wouldn't you know it, electricity. And as he hits the ground, he grabs the stick, picks it up. We are now in Rising Dragon form.
Rising Dragon form has a punching power of 1.7 tons and a kicking power of 5.8. It can jump up to 50 meters and runs 100 meters in 2 seconds. That's 223.7 miles per hour, in case you were curious.
Wow.
Fast as fuck, boys.
Its weapon is the Rising Dragon Rod.
I would have called it Dragon Spear.
Dragon Lance, something like that, yeah.
I think Dragon Lance is copyrighted.
Shh.
Its finisher is the Rising Splash Dragon.
Suffice to say, much cooler version.
It's amazing what adding a bit of gold to dragon form does to improve it.
Yeah, because they didn't just do, like, the symbol bands around the collar. They also added, like, because dragon form was pretty plain before.
Yeah.
The shoulder pads were just the ovals, but they added edging to all of it in gold. It looks crisp. It looks clean. It looks great.
I've been incredibly harsh on dragon form, and I like Rising Dragon. The gold etching along the chest, the shoulders, on the back of his, they're not quite gloves. It's just like a wrist plate.
Yeah, it's
and
reminiscent of some like the old Edo style wrist armor.
Yeah. And then the Rising Dragon Rod being a double-ended spear now.
Yes.
Looks really cool.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
I will agree. The one thing, though, is it's still a tippity-tap.
It is. It's a bladed lance, and he just pokes her in the sternum with it.
Now, I will admit that it's a bit cooler, because he hits her in the stomach, the symbol forms, and he just throws her out into the water.
Yeah, she just got yeeted.
She hits, explodes, very real fire on the water.
Excruciating, you know.
He did the Monster Mash. The Monster Mash.
I was ready for it this time.
So was I.
Yeah.
Who doesn't want a hot, fashionable goth girlfriend at some point in their life?
So is that a mash?
Plus, pianists are known to have talented fingers. Not to mention she has experience with whips, and an alluring dom energy. She's a mash. I'll just make sure I provide the whip.
Probably a good call there.
Yeah. Yeah, the text-to-speech made it sound like peonists, and that's fairly appropriate for the segment, I think. She definitely looked like that little kid who peed in that pool. That was the face. That was the face right there. The water turned blue in a cloud by a kid, and she's like, God, I had to murder two people, and now there's pee in the pool? Nah, I'm fucking leaving.
You know who else watches the destruction of Vimeo?
Yeah, speaking of numbers, it's Doldo.
Doldo, who hey there, takes Doldo. The abacus, turns it sideways, and shakes it.
God, to be like, that's the most emotion we've gotten out of that character in a while. It's just the exasperation as he shakes the abacus, like, God damn it.
There's also another Gurungi with him who is the most stereotypical Yakuza ever.
God, yes.
And that is Gogamegorei.
Mob boss Marco for the rest of us.
Yes. And he's like, well, that was impressive, but I've got this. You sure, buddy?
You know, everybody says that. Everybody wrong.
Everybody wrong. Yeah. Maybe God, I'm going to hate it when James Dean dies.
There's no telling if he's going to die. He clearly has the kit to be a Kamen Rider. He could just take over, change a heart.
I like that idea.
Yeah.
But with that, that's the end of the episode. So let's go ahead and pick what we want to rank this on.
I propose Xiong Sam's.
That's hard to pronounce. I was going to say sheet music.
Or missing buttons.
Only you were bothered by that.
I was so bothered by that.
How do we settle this?
Sheet music.
Sheet music?
Sheet music will do.
Okay. So let's start with Bemiu. And you want to go first? Go for it.
I like human design. The Tai Xiong Zhem gives a serpentine feel and features a serpent dragon. The sarong in her swimsuit has a sort of scale feel to it. Her hair even resembles the hood thing she wears in monster form. Speaking of monster forms, I love hers. Classic villain colors in purple and green, which is also probably my favorite color combo. She has a snake stomach pattern and some interesting color blocking. My only complaint is that she has a pretty boring silhouette. 4.5 on this design. Behavior is probably Bimiu's weakest point. Not that it's bad, just kind of flat. She mixes that general grungy attitude with a coldness and condescending aloofness we don't usually see. She almost seems annoyed to even be participating. She does like music puns. I think her love of music is supposed to reference snake charming. An above average 3.5. After watching Kuga the first time, there were four attack patterns that stuck with me. Garrido and his box truck, Jinoga and his assault, Bimiu's ridiculousness, and one more we haven't gotten to yet. Her plan is stupidly complex, but that's what makes it fun. I honestly don't know how Inoue even thought of this plan. 5 out 5. Exactly the crazy bullshit I love from this show. That's a 4.3 repeating overall.
We can just do it in reverse order today, yeah. So this was a weird one for me. Sea Snake Sandy over here. Appearance, I'm going to give pretty high marks to. This is one of the more colorful Grungy we've seen. I love the purple and green interplay in terms of the Grungy form. Like even the chest plates, the curved scale chest plates up near the neck and part of her outfit. Like all of it worked very well. The headpiece she had on had chain link that looked like scale patterning. Aesthetically, this was one of the cooler Grungy we've seen. The same color as some of the ones we've seen before, but definitely more dynamism as some, like our fish guy, Piranha Pauly.
Byron-Gi was colorful, but he was not purple.
No, that's what I'm saying. We have some of the same like levels of coloration, but this one's silhouette, I think, was stronger than his, and the overall design aesthetic was a little better for me. Human form had the skin tight affect, gave kind of like, you know, the sinewy appearance. I liked that. I'm going to give this a 4. This is going to be a stronger rated appearance for me. Behavior, I'm going to kind of go the opposite direction because my interpretation of this character is one that is compulsive in nature. I'm going to give credit, because otherwise this is just some outlandish batshit bullshit, and say that this is like compulsive serial killer behavior, in which she has a method and she has a behavior, almost OCD. She has to adhere to this behavior set. And for me, that kind of became evident when she had to sit down at the piano and play the music. She saw an opportunity to play the music and could not pass. She knows she's being pursued. She knows that, like, she's in a game. There are time constraints. There is a crunch, but she still sits down to play the full set of sheet music. To me, that speaks to compulsion. To me, that is part of a more fleshed out character than some of the other Gronki we've seen who are just arrogant. So I'm also going to give her a 4 on behavior. Unfortunately, where this one part a little bit for me is in terms of like the actual methodology of the killing itself. I didn't like it as much because of the cold. It doesn't make sense. The sub-zero temperature whip being something to do with sea snakes, of all things? Like, I don't know. There is a weird relationship out in the ecosystem where the further away you get from the equator, the less venomous and poisonous creatures you find. Think about a venomous creature you can find in Alaska or Siberia. It's just not going to happen. Cold is not associated with venomous creatures. Venom is generally reserved for higher metabolic needs. That means equatorial, things like snakes, spiders, venomous lizards, those things tend to have venom. Cold is not something associated with venom. So for me, I liked the idea of the sea snake. That was pretty cool. But this was a miss in terms of the actual execution of the methodology. The method of killing wasn't there for me. Like, I get that the whip is indicative of, like, the speed of a striking snake. That's fine. Give it a poison barb. Give it a venomed tip. Give it something that speaks to snake, but cold didn't get there for me. So for me, that methodology brought it down to a 2. And that brings a 4, a 4, and a 2 brings my score to a 3.33 repeating, which is still over 50% and still leaves it probably in the top 50% of my rated Gronki.
I guess I'll start with behavior. I agree with points that you both have made. Yes, I believe her behavior is incredibly compulsive. Something about this piece of music, this piece of Linto culture, resonated with her in a way that nothing else did, to the point that she decides to not only, like, devote her focus on it, carrying the music around, but her game will be played based off this as well. It doesn't quite tie in quite as well as the owl reading philosophy, but it's still really interesting to see that this is what she latched onto. I also agree with what you said, where she seems to be bothered by playing the game. She would much rather be spending her time playing this piece of music, being devoted to it, to the point that it's almost kind of sad that she has to play the game. Is this a Gronki who otherwise wouldn't have? Who can say?
Because we haven't seen, like, they're not compelled to play.
At least not that we know of. They all willingly choose to, it
seems.
Yeah,
so that's an interesting observation.
Can't say with her.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, her... Yeah, she seems bothered by having to do this. Like, ugh, yes, I know it's what I need to do, but I'm only doing it so I can get back to what I really want to do. And that is a thing we have not seen at all. We have seen cold aloofness. We have seen annoyance from arrogancy. We have not seen this. And that's, yeah, that's worth giving credit to. I think behavior, I'm gonna go with a 4. Design. There's more color in her monster form than I think we've seen in any other than maybe the very first shot of Byron-Gi when we only saw his face, and it was green and blue and white and pink, because they took away a lot of the color when he finally actually played the game himself. She is purple and green. She has red on her face, just in a couple spots to make her eyes pop a bit more. The chain is a blackened metal, but except on her wrist, where it's a very clear bronze color. There's so much color in her design compared to any other Gronki we've seen. And because she is a snake, the more simple silhouette works. Like you guys have said, the bits coming off of the head sculpt, the chainmail looking like scales, all of that plays into what she is. I agree, there's very little correlation between sea snake and cold, but you know what? I'm going to give that a pass. Her human form, yes, the skin-tight nature of all of her outfits plays into that serpentine. I didn't really think it matched as well initially watching, but as you were bringing up, it's like, oh yeah, that does. It's a great design. Well executed. It's not anything groundbreaking, but it doesn't have to be in this case. It is still a exceedingly well executed design. 4.5. Methodology is insanity. Yes, this compulsive need to recreate this piece of music that she is obsessed with, that she has to stop playing the game to play the music because it is that important to her, to come up with the idea of these victims will represent this time signature to the note. Like, she was doomed to fail from the get-go. I don't believe, even without Kuga there, that she could have completed the game in time just because of the complexity that she gave herself. But man, it's so smart, it becomes stupid and wraps all the way back around to being admirable. I will remember this particular method years from now because of how much it stands out in the, I can't believe they did that. I'm now fascinated by whatever this fourth one you remember is in the future. But it just makes me smile. It makes me laugh. It's so brilliant. It's so dumb. It's both simultaneously. 4.5 again. Which, 4.5, 4.5, and a 4. That brings me to a 4.333 repeating, of course. Sheet music.
That's a 3.99, boys.
Yeah.
That is as close as you can get to a 4 without being a 4 as is literally possible.
Do we want to keep the same order for episode? All right.
Sure.
Then Jed?
Things hit a little close to home for our heroes this week. You know things are serious when Pol Pol is somber. The exploration of Nana's emotions after having lost a teacher, and now just narrowly avoiding a Granji attack by sheer luck. Meanwhile, Keiko is grappling with what it means to bring a child into a world with a Granji. It makes for a very poignant story. It's really nice when the main plot has a direct effect on the episode side plots. Inoue has his problems, but he knows how to milk the drama. A 5. There is some beautiful cinematography in this episode. They continue to feature the Granji in some of the best shots in the series. Here this layer feels cramped and claustrophobic. There are several awesome effects with Bada and Baruba's conversation. Just everything about the bike fight was wonderfully shot. The rack zoom. They even did a pretty good frost effect on Kuga's shoulder. 5 out of 5. And oh man, the fights. Bada versus Kuga in a clash of bike foo titans. So many good stunts, but the flip off the bike was coolest of all. For Bimiyu's fight, staff versus whip is just a fun set of weapons to pair against each other, and they execute it amazingly. I think this is another 5 for me. I think these will be fights I compare future fights against. That's a straight 5 for the episode. My first perfect score.
Damn.
Yeah, that's a hard act to follow. So for me, this one is going to rank high. It's not that high for me, but I'm going to start with cinematography because we did have a lot of really cool shots. That rack zoom for me, it put me right back in that same like emotional content as the first time I watched Jaws and saw that rack zoom in Jaws. Because it works. It's a very, very effective tool. And that wasn't the only cool piece of cinematography we saw between these episodes. The transitional shots between different fight scenes made the fights more believable. Like, we had a lot. We didn't have any One of the things I look for when I look for cinematography is the special effects that are used, and we didn't have any bad CGI used here, at least not compared to some of the stuff we've seen before. What they did use, they used well, they used their blending well enough to make it appear fluid and natural in the back. We used a lot more practical effects these episodes, and that worked for me. That worked for me really well. So I'm actually going to go with a 4.5 on cinematography. For the overarching plot, this one didn't hit as hard for me personally. You know, maybe it's just a little bit of burnout on my part. We do have a tendency in the series to pump the brakes to go to slow-moving stories packed with emotional content. And for me, the payout on this one wasn't as worth the journey as some of the other ones we've seen. And we didn't have enough strong plot content in this to drive that forward in spite of that for me. So for me, the plot on this episode is going to be a 3. I'm looking for different stuff than you guys are. And that can also be said that like a lot of the stuff in this that I found compelling about these episodes weren't necessarily plot related. You know, James Dean being suave, doing cool bike foo. Those scenes were incredible. Those were incredibly strong fight scenes, but his attitude and his demeanor doesn't really weigh into the plot. Fights, I'm actually going to go with a 4.5. And I'm going to go with that high because first episode we got some really, really cool high quality bike foo. Again, very cool practical effects at use in those fight scenes. There was some CGI, you know, bikes jumping over bikes, that sort of thing. But the practical effects that were used here made these fights a lot more believable. The only unbelievable part of CGI in the entire set of fight scenes, I would say, is after we get yeeted out to sea, watch a massive explosion that doesn't cause any ripples in the ocean. But yeah, like the use of set pieces during our fight scenes, the length of the fight scenes, the different ways we watch the fights develop and become dynamic, the first rod getting broken by this ice power, and then him having to find a different one before he finally escalates to his final form, the fight had a good ebb and flow to it, and I appreciate it. So I'm, again, 4.5 on fights. That brings my total to a bog standard 4.
All right. Let's see, plot. Anytime that there has been a plot revolving around familial concerns, the show has affected me. And in the past, within Akita, it's made me uncomfortable at times. And I felt a comfort in this one because Keiko's anxieties are completely understandable. It is, like I said, I have been through these conversations myself, and I wish I'd seen something like that growing up. Because there were some moments at times where it was like, is this a normal thing to worry about? And I think if I had seen it in media at any point in my life growing up, I'd be like, yeah, no, it's normal to have these anxieties, and here's the things to work through. I'm in awe that this show continues to tackle such subjects and put them in what is karate fighting Bugman on motorcycle. Like, when we watched the Masked Rider special, like, that's what TV in America looked like, especially at the time when we were growing up. Mm-hmm. And how dare that be what we were given when we could have had this?
Oh, agreed.
Every scene with Bada is a joy. He is my favorite Garangi. He's incredible. Seeing how close our secondary cast came to, you know, in a very, yeah, life works this way, by pure happenstance, managed to avoid tragedy. It wasn't through planning or anything on their part, just the purest of coincidence. And life works that way. I gotta give a 5. Cinematography, I'm just going to go say, it's a 5. There wasn't a bad shot. Like we've all gushed on, that rack zoom was such a perfect moment. The fight scenes are captured dynamically. I have no complaints towards cinematography at all. This should be the gold standard for this series moving forward. The diegetic use of the Chopin music throughout, everything is just so good. Combat. Again, the Bada fight's perfect. I love every moment of it. The jaw-dropping awe for me of Bada transforming his bike to get these two supernaturally powered vehicles striking at each other. The great use of the environment of just crashing through things, the boxes for Bada's entrance, Kuga going into the gas cans leading into the explosion, the mid-air clash jumping off bikes, the ramping over each other. It's gorgeous. It's perfect. The fight with Bimiu, I agree. Staff versus whip is an interesting combination because, yeah, they're two weapons that should not match up against each other. The practical use of the dragon rod shattering because it is frozen, the use of the effect on his shoulder. I love seeing Kuga's armor get damaged. It adds a weight to the fights when that happens. Redeeming dragon form for me, because, yeah, Rising Dragon looks great. All of the Rising forms look great. I think my least favorite might actually be Rising Pegasus.
Actually, yeah, can second on that.
At least of the ones we've seen so far, because we still haven't seen Rising Mighty. The finisher, still a little weak to me. It's better than the original Splash Dragon, and there's something comedic about the way he just yucks her into the ocean. I'm torn because part of me wants to match you and give it a 5 as well, and there's another part of me that's like, nah, the combat's almost there, but not quite perfect.
That's the only reason I haven't been giving 5s on these, is just because I feel like we're going to have more impressive stuff coming, and I don't want to taint my scores.
I think I'm going to go with my gut and give a 4.5 to combat. So a 5, a 5, and a 4.5 brings me to a 4.8333 repeating.
Which brings our grand total for this episode to 4.6111 pages of sheet music.
That is our highest scored episode.
Yeah, it is.
My God, Revival's been dethroned.
Technically, because it ties with Uneasiness and Strength.
Oh. What more is there to say that we haven't already said? This was a blast.
Mm-hmm.
These were great to watch. In that case, join us next week when we'll be watching episodes 29 and 30, Crossroads and Fate.
You can reach us by email at commentarytrack@gmail.com or on Twitter at commentarytrack. You can support us at patreon.com/thecommentarytrack. For just $5 a month, you get access to monthly bonus episodes. Most recently, we watched Saban's Masked Rider, so you don't have to.
Seems a downright shame.
Have a little beast.